The Babylon Line is a new play and also a leg of the Long Island Railroad that connects Midtown Manhattan to the prosaic commuter suburbs, which already had an image in 1967 as homogenous and soul-deadening. And that's the tough reverse commute writer Aaron Port makes once a week to teach his adult education class. Most of the students enrolled in his creative writing class after their first choices, like French cooking or flower arranging, filled up. But one student, a reclusive, neurotic young woman, may just be a fellow writer, even a soulmate. It's at the Mitzi E. Newhouse Theater at Lincoln Center until January 22nd. And join us now are playwright Richard Greenberg and actors Josh Radner and Elizabeth Reeser. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And Josh and Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thank you.
The play takes place in 1967, but also today. Is it fair to describe it as a memory play?
It's fair. It doesn't always make me that happy because when I was starting as a playwright, we didn't like any memory plays except for one, The Glass Menagerie.
Pretty
and then
good
it all
one.
Felt like a big falling off. But because there's a sense that that's sentimental and dreamy, and this isn't quite sentimental and dreamy, but it is a play that reflects, so go ahead, call it what you want.
And you've written in another play that nostalgia is just a longing for a time we know we can handle.
Or we know we can survive. This is my own theory, and I'm sticking to it.
I love it, by the way.
Thank
you. I quote that to people.
Did that turn out to be the case here?
What do you mean? In terms of this?
Yeah, nostalgia.
In terms of the material of the play? I realized this about nostalgia when I found I was once sick, and they didn't know what it was, and I was in the hospital for 7 weeks. And then afterwards, I found myself being nostalgic for a hospital. And I thought, okay. And I think it must just be that I got out of there. And you know what? I would say, to say that I survived, but
everything.
I think I actually have, I'm ambivalent about everything, but I grew up in the suburbs, and I cannot say that I have the appropriate feelings of antagonism toward them.
You grew up in the area that you're kind of covering
about
in this
2 minutes away from
Levittown.
Yeah.
Aaron talks directly to the audience, setting the stage, and then comments on the action and participates in it almost simultaneously. Don't most writing teachers insist on show, don't tell?
Yeah, but that's why I don't listen to them.
Josh, do you feel maybe not that you're playing Richard to some degree, but you're playing the role of Richard in creating the play and recreating a bit of Aaron's life for us?
That's interesting. I certainly I've stolen little ticks from Richard, but just little hand things. You haven't noticed?
I didn't. Well, I don't know what I do.
Well, I think of Aaron and Joan together as somehow being different parts of Richard, but I don't want to psychoanalyze you.
I was going to ask Elizabeth that very question. You play Joan, a talented but deeply neurotic student, and you've said in interviews that when you're working in film, you try to make the words disappear, but you really can't do that here.
Well, it's the opposite, and I do think that in film, so often it's not about the words, it's about the moment and whatever that is, and sometimes it's just mistakes, and that's the most exciting thing that you can see. But in this, it's the complete opposite, because Richard's language, it's you like live or die with this language. I mean, it feels life and death being out there saying these things, but it's everything, the words, and but you also have to make it feel like that's how these people talk.
Well, I've had actors tell me that the best way to play Shakespeare is just trust the words and the rest will take care of itself. Some playwrights give you better words to trust than others.
Well, that's exactly it. It's like you either get on the train, not to be overly corny, but that is what it feels like with Richard's language. And if you commit to it and invest in it, it does take you where you need to go.
Whose idea was it to make Joan Southern? Is that in the script?
It was not in the script. I was told, Terry Kinney, the director, told me that was Richard's secret about her.
The secret? I've written another play where the heroine was Southern, and so I was loath to admit that she was Southern for a while.
But the accent really works for this character.
If you look at the rhythms, it's so clear that I was writing a Southern woman, and I finally decided, let's cop to it.
It also makes her more exotic in that classroom.
She's supposed to not seem to fit where she is, and that's very helpful.
Many of your plays deal with the flow of time and how that's changed by perspective and the relationship between characters. Why are you so interested in how time passes?
I don't know. But it is my obsession. I remember, I said this before, I feel my sensibility was formed once when I was watching a PBS pledge drive marathon of the Foresight saga, the original one. It was just, they show the whole thing over something like 24 hours, and I would check in on it and then go and do a task and check in on it, and 20 years had passed. And there was something about watching this entire, this saga, I don't know even how many years the Foresight saga takes place over, but seeing it that way with gaps, sort of missing out on some of the information, that was so powerful. And so much more powerful than just watching it in the regular
because
way.
Because we fill in the gaps.
Well,
we
fill in the gaps and you wonder what's missing. And you just feel that time is immutable. That time is just unstoppable is what I meant. But, and I wanted to create something like that from that PBS pledge drive.
Well, because it was still only a series. The Forsythes were living their lives at a much more rapid pace than
exactly.
any of us. When was this? Is this before you started writing plays?
You know, I never can. Another thing about time is I never can remember when anything happened. I think it might have been when I was in drama school and I was home for a break.
Josh, your character Aaron goes back and forth in time. Do you see him as two versions of the same person?
I do, but I also, it's the kind of thing of. What is that thing, like our cells, like every 7 years we have completely different, like basically our biology is completely different, but there's this kind of thread of memory that runs throughout. I mean, he feels, I think all the things you see, you know, he says when he's 86, things turned out nicely. And he says when he's 38, things turned out badly. And I think I play the narrator with much more gusto and joy in telling the story. And when I pop back into the story, the thing I love about this play is that these are people who think they're in the middle of a tragedy, but they're not. And I think there's something so beautiful about that construction that we know, the audience, and almost by mistake because the narrator spills the beans, but we know that they, you know, it's what did you describe it as, like your sad, happy play or your... something like that. But it's people, you know, it's really beautifully tragic and sad, but ultimately not. And
yeah.
But it's a thinker. I mean, that's some of the things you have to unpack when you leave, you know.
I like leaving things for people to unpack.
Well, as you mentioned, you talk to the audience directly. Are we confidants or co-creators? Or is Aaron just trying out the story on us because he's also a writer?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a first draft. I mean, to him.
The play begins with him saying, the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he steps out on stage with great intention, and I think he means to rigorously edit himself. But what happens is, because he's an older man and he gets flooded with information and memory, and he can't not say it.
And Richard, did you intend his saying the end at the beginning as a warning, or were you just informing us what the play is about to some degree?
I think it would probably be more the latter. I think the idea is, what is it to end? There's the quote from, what is the quote? Okay, I haven't been in a while, but where he says at the beginning, Walter Benjamin says, death sanctions all endings. But
all
without
stories,
death, the endings we improvise are just improvisations. That's not Walter Benjamin, that's me. and that's really what the play is. It's so in a way, it's about the perils of telling a story in which not everyone has died.
We're speaking about a new play from Richard Greenberg, his latest. How many have you written altogether?
I have no idea.
A lot.
I read on a book that it's 25, but I don't know.
The Babylon Line, and it's two stars, Josh Radner and Elizabeth Reeser. It's currently at the Mitzi E. Newhouse Theater at Lincoln Center and running until January 22nd. I was thinking in that moving back and forth, do writers tend to experience life and think of it as material at the same time?
Yes.
My brother is a writer, and every so often at family dinners, this was years ago, but because he's cleverer about it now, he would suddenly look like he was drifting away, and somebody would say, Philip is thinking about how he can use this in something he's writing. And
yes.
You're nodding your head.
Yes. Yes, it's all. It's what is it? Nora Ephron used to quote her mother, who said, "What is it? Everything's
copy. Material, or everything's copy." Yeah, yeah.
It's true. You're a predator in your social life.
I notice sometimes when just anyone drops like a little phrase, like I'll just really quickly say, "Great title," you know, fantastic title.
Yeah. This happened to me with the play I've written since this play. Oh. It was someone who woke me up, and I don't sleep. And she said, "I'm sorry, I would never deliberately intrude on your morsel of sleep." And I said, "That's a good title."
Ooh,
and
morsel
it is the
sleep.
Title of my next play.
Now, Elizabeth, Joan has been a recluse. How long has she been in her house?
Well, she has not left the house in 7 years.
But so what brought her to this class?
Well, according to what she says at one point, it was on a whim. That's a great question for Richard Greenberg, actually. I mean, she's...
Yeah, but you give yourself backstory. Every actor gives.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would think that she feels like she's going to die. I mean, like, it's either she has to step outside and move forward or, you know... I have a whole backstory about her mother and, you know, I mean, like, not leaving the house is like a really serious, serious thing. I mean, she's not like kidding about that. It's not a half, you know, way thing that she's doing. So I think for me, as I relate to it, I think it's life or death.
Is it fair to say that both Joan and Aaron are intensive readers, but that they don't read the same things?
Well, I think Joan has definitely read everything that Aaron's ever read.
But she can't get him to read Colette.
No, she's read much more.
She's
dipped
into
a
the female
more
canon
time.
More than Aaron.
But
has.
Men enjoy reading Colette. Some men.
Not this. Not Aaron Porritt.
Well, not at that time. I mean, I don't think Colette still gets the respect that she deserves.
Well, Aaron, I love thinking about Aaron's reading list because I think he's really enthralled by the kind of masculine, you know, post-war macho guys, you know, Roth and Mailer and Bellow, and I think he fancies himself a tougher guy than he is as a writer and as a person. I love the unveiling of his tender side, that he can't quite do the knockout punch, you know, as a writer.
Richard, weren't you a recluse for a while?
No, I just pretend to be because it gets you out of things. You know, it's just, I'm sorry.
So I thought it might have been related to the sickness you were mentioning.
Yeah, I can't come because it's a psychological imperative. Do you know? I mean, so no, I've never been, but I position myself as a recluse, but I don't really live that way.
Well, you seem to be having a good time. So why have you resisted doing this sort of thing in the past?
Doing which sort of thing?
Having a conversation of the sort we're having.
I don't know. I'd probably go to a shrink if I didn't think it would take up too much of my material. Do you know? I don't know.
Well, look at the shrink's notes. You'll have a couple plays out of it.
I know that people have already written those plays.
You're so good at talking, though, Richard. We like hearing from you.
Sometimes I feel I'm a terrible talker because I talk in drafts. I'm constantly doubling back and starting sentences over.
Is it my imagination that a lot of people will admit to growing up near Levittown but not from Levittown?
I don't know. The truth is, I did not grow up in Levittown, and I would have loved to admit that sort of thing. I grew up truly, it truly is 1 or 2 minutes away, depending on if the light is red.
One of your characters reads an essay where she was told by the developer to keep her grass shorter.
That was true. He was very dictatorial in those days when Levittown was new. He would patrol and he would criticize and he would give orders.
Is it true that you've referred to the three housewives in Aaron's class as the Furies?
That was
that
Terry
in the back
Kinney's,
of your head when you created
because it's the same three actresses who did it 2 years ago when we were 2.5 years ago when we were at Vassar, and they became really close. And yes, Terry started that, and now it's become official.
Who are they to Joan?
Well, Joan is not in their world, and Joan doesn't have children, and that's a big part of what they're about. But also, Joan just doesn't know how to talk to. She doesn't know how to perform womanhood, I think, in the way that they do, and which I can really relate to, and just how strange it can feel to suddenly be in the world and then suddenly have these women. you know, in your face or asking you questions, but in real life, they're the most loving, most wonderful, most brilliant people.
And, well, they invite her to go out one night, but she doesn't want to do it.
Yes, they invite her to Jan's for strawberry ice cream sodas.
Now, I know, Richard, that your plays are not autobiographical, but isn't it true that, well, that a lot of the things here do come out of your life?
Joan's chief nemesis, who in real life would not have been her nemesis because she was a much more ample woman than that, was based on
Frieda.
My favorite Frieda, played brilliantly by Randy Graff, is my favorite mother of a friend. And she was brilliantly happy in – I'm from East Meadow, and she was incredibly happy there and queenly. And loved it. And no one ever wrote about that particular, or I didn't see people writing about a woman this smart, this witty, this in charge of herself, this happy at that place.
Now, Elizabeth and Josh, you've gone back and forth between film, television, and theater. In the past, every actor started in theater. Did both of you start in theater?
Yeah, we both did. We
and
both
you've
went
worked
to
together in the past.
Here. Yeah, we have worked together. Josh directed me in his movie.
Oh, wow.
Liberal Arts, yeah.
Just one more thing, Richard. Can you explain to us, using the Drew Barrymore analogy that you've referred to in the past?
This, oh my, how much
time? And we have very little time.
Yeah, we don't. Well, it's just, you know, it's... I'm just saying, because the ending of the play causes a lot of conversation.
There's confusion.
I would say
about
that if you look at Drew Barrymore's life and you only look at the first part of it, you're talking about someone who is going to be dead by 20. And if you look at her whole life, you're looking at someone who ended up having a fantastically happy and successful life.
And that's why we start with the end.
That's it.
The Babylon Line is currently at the Mitzi E. Newhouse Theater at Lincoln Center until January 22nd. My great thanks to Richard Greenberg, Josh Radner, and Elizabeth Reza for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.